Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. It's Monday morning. That means the Monday morning movie reviews are coming up right now. Eric Childress, Colin Suter join me every Monday morning to review all the new movies. We were off last week for the holiday, so we're going to play catch-up. We got a lot of movies to talk about. Coming up again, it's Monday, so my dad's going to call in and tell a joke a little bit later on, and we are going to talk about some of the classic movie quotes of all time. That's all on the show, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And, so let's get to it, because there's a lot to talk about, and we haven't been on. This is, we missed last Monday morning, so let's get the guys in. Eric Childress. Eric, welcome.
Hello.
And Colin Suter. Colin, welcome.
Hello there.
Did you guys have a good Thanksgiving?
Very good.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Great. Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
And we got a lot to talk about. We should start with the stuff that we missed last week. There was only really one big one last week, correct?
Wonder also came out.
Oh, right. Yeah. See, you know what? I haven't seen that one yet. Let's start out with Wonder. Colin, you're the only one who saw it, I think.
Okay.
All right.
So this is based on the New York Times best-selling novel about a kid named Augie, played by Jacob Tremblay, who's the kid from Room from a couple years ago. He's born with a facial disfigurement. He's had 26 surgeries since he was born, and now at the age of 10, he and his family decide maybe it's time he go to a public school and, try to make friends instead of being homeschooled by his mom. And he has a couple friends before school starts, thanks to the school's principal, played by Mandy Patinkin, who took some preemptive measures to make sure Augie had some friends before the first day. But of course, it's still a rough transition, and not everybody is that welcoming when they see him. And like the book, this movie takes on multiple points of view, including his older sister, played by Isabella Vidovic, and she has problems at school of her own that the movie explores. And the movie spans a whole year, school year, as we see the story unfold from multiple viewpoints, but not as some sort of Rashomon-like gimmick, although there's a little of that, but more as a way of generating empathy for all the characters, even when it looks like they're doing the wrong thing at times. I should mention that Julia Roberts and Owen Wilson play the parents here. And this is, like I said, is based on the bestseller, which I've read. And it's full disclosure, I have a very personal attachment to this movie because the book was inspired by a student that went to the school that I work at, and so I knew that person, and so it's hard for me to come at this movie completely unbiased, but this is also this is a film directed by Steven Chbosky, who directed Perks of Being a Wallflower, which was my favorite film of 2012. So there you go, another bias. Nevertheless, I'm confident that this is a very good film. And can recommend it wholeheartedly. It's absolutely the kind of movie that when you look at the trailer, like, ooh, this could be really treacly and, schmaltzy and corny. And, they probably lay on the music really thick when emotional things are happening. It just looks like a bad Disease of the Week film. But this has been adapted really thoughtfully. And really, Steven Chbosky is really good at, first of all, casting the film. Every kid in this movie looks the part and acts like a real kid. The movie actually improves on the book as far as the parents are concerned. There's a lot more going on with the parents. There's more depth to them. Owen Wilson actually is funny in it instead of, in the book we're just being told that he's funny, even though not really. And I think that, all the young actors, even the teenage roles are exceptionally well cast as well. And the movie knows exactly when to pull back on the schmaltz and exactly when to cut away and exactly when and when not to use music. And it gives the actors a lot of space and a lot of time to, really develop these characters and really make them worthy of the audience's sympathy. I got a couple issues with the adaptation. There are things that I wish they could change to make it a better film. Nevertheless, I breathed a sigh of relief when it was over and realized that they made as good a movie from this, almost as good a movie from this book as anybody could have. And it is not the corny, predictable schmaltz fest that some might think. And Jacob Tremblay showed that, room was no fluke. This kid is a tremendously gifted young actor, so I definitely recommend Wonder.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that, because what you say people might think of the trailer is exactly what I thought when I saw the trailer.
Yeah,
I mean, I was like, oh God, this is going to be So well, okay, I'm good. It's good to hear. Good to hear. Okay, now Colin, you didn't see Justice League.
I did not,
okay.
Because the timing of the screenings just did not work out, and I never made a chance to see it.
Yeah, I can understand why. Eric, tell us about Justice League.
Okay, there's an evil coming. There's a war coming. This is what we're told by Batman and Wonder Woman in the film. Everyone knows what Justice League essentially is. This is the new film directed by Zack Snyder, I suppose, that is going to team together the heroes that we've seen in some of the previous DC films, notably Batman and Wonder Woman, who we saw in Batman versus Superman. But now we're getting the rest of the people, rest of the heroes from the from the infamous dossier that Batman briefly saw in that movie. Notably, we got Aquaman, played by Jason Momoa. We have Barry Allen, also known as the Flash, played by
Ezra Miller.
I was going to say Zach Miller. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's a bear.
Yeah,
Ezra Miller and Cyborg. And the actor's name I'm forgetting.
Ray Fisher.
There you go. Pretty much like the character itself.
Yeah.
So Batman is going to get all these characters together because there is some ancient space evil known as Steppenwolf, who is going to come down and unleash his Moth Monster Man minions from some otherworldly thing.
I got to say real quick, Eric, I know that the Steppenwolf character exists in the DC universe in the comics.
Uh-huh.
But every time I heard them say it, I just laughed, and I was hoping Born to Wild would play on the soundtrack.
Yeah, sure.
So, yeah, okay.
Sure, and I just saw the theater company.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And why not? Because those two, you're thinking of the band, me thinking of the theater company, is more of a backstory than we're really given about this character himself.
Right.
He's a pretty lame villain. Anyway, all that being aside, the first, half of this movie is getting the team together, and then they're going to, discover their, their powers or whatever they're going to do, and they're going to team up to, destroy Steppenwolf. That's basically all you need to know about this movie, other than the fact that if you're thinking of going to see this movie, is that it absolutely stinks.
Yep.
People want to, we all like to rank these movies, and the DC films have obviously suffered in a variety of creative reasons compared to the Marvel thing. Now, I'm not here to do a whole Marvel versus DC rant at all, but the DC films have been challenged in many ways. But I'm here to say that Justice League is actually worse than Batman versus Superman, because Batman versus Superman at least seemed to have some sort of vision to it. It seemed to have, however flawed that vision might have been, it seemed like Zack Snyder was at least trying to potentially explore something, and set up this rivalry between these two characters that we never would think would be, fight each other, except those who, are loyal to the comics. It didn't work, but at least it felt like there is some semblance of a vision. Now, reportedly, this film has been monkeyed with quite a bit, to the point that now people are now wanting all the people that hated Batman vs Superman now want Zack Snyder's 3-hour director's cut of this movie apparently released. Well, we know Zack Snyder had to leave to tend to a personal family tragedy. Joss Whedon was called in to basically fill in the gaps, do some reshoots, and fill in a few things that they hadn't finished yet. And the executives at Warner Brothers basically said, we have to get this movie under 2 hours. So the film is just a flat line from beginning to end. There's very, very little humor in the film. There's a lot of attempts at humor, very little of it lands. The action scenes are inconsequential and are not interesting or exciting in any way. Some of the special effects are really bad. I really hope that, I know that this is not exactly boding well for DC's future, but I know James Wan is doing Aquaman right now, and I certainly hope that the underwater sequences are better in that film than they are in this film, because all I kept thinking about was how much better they were in Top Secret. and it's a better fight, frankly, than any fight in this movie. It wasn't so much bored. I was waiting to feel anything, waiting to feel outrage or excited, or that was a cool moment. We haven't even mentioned, the return of Superman in this movie. And anyone who thinks that's a spoiler, what do you think? It's like going to see Star Trek 3 and thinking that Spock's not going to return, for God's sakes. Just don't be fooled by this movie. DC and everyone involved has failed miserably again. And everyone who got so excited over Wonder Woman this summer are going to watch this character take an absolute backslide to everyone involved. They, like Whedon, I guess probably, added a little Wonder Woman to it, but it feels like a lot less. I just walked away from this movie just more than indifferent to it, and I can't believe anyone would support it.
Okay. All right, Eric, hang on. Eric and Colin, hang on. We got to take a break here for the news. We'll come back. I'll tell you what I thought of Justice League, and then we'll talk about the movies that came out this weekend as well. All the new movies, holiday time, and it's movie reviews on Monday morning. We'll take a break. The news is up next. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Glad to be back. So glad to be back after a break there for a while. And I miss you guys, and I miss doing this show, and I'm happy to be back. It's Monday morning. That means my dad will call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about some of the classic and greatest quotes in movie history as well. And speaking of movies, we had a lot to talk about this morning. It's the Monday morning movie reviews with Eric Childress and Colin Suter. We'll return to that in a second. If you want to get a hold of us, you can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. And you can call us or text us at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We are here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. Everybody's back and we're ready to go. All right, let's get back to the reviews. Here's Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Hi, Colin.
Hello.
Before the news, Eric told us about Justice League and his dislike of it. I liked it even less than you did, Eric. I thought it was awful. I thought it was incomprehensible. Half of the time, I'm not kidding, Eric. I didn't know what the hell was going on. Now, I did not go back and watch Superman versus Batman, or whatever the hell, Batman versus Superman again. So I was all caught up because Batman versus Superman's a piece of crap. So I didn't go back and watch it again. So maybe some of the stuff that I was a little bit confused by would have been answered if I remembered anything about that movie.
Oh, actually, Nick, you wouldn't know. It would have actually been more confusing.
Oh, really?
Because there's stuff. If you remember, there's a moment in Batman vs. Superman where Batman kind of meets the Flash and some sort of telepathic thing.
Yeah.
That's never brought up in Justice League. You remember?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, when he meets him, he says, "I don't know what your power is."
Right.
In this movie, if he met him psychically in the first one, he should know.
Well,
All right. Well, anyway, the structure of the movie is awful. You can tell that there were reshoots aplenty. Whedon got a screenplay credit on it.
Yeah.
So the gathering of the group at the beginning is boring. All of the characters have annoyances. Except for Wonder Woman. The Wonder Woman character is the only one that doesn't annoy me. And you're right though, Eric. After seeing her standalone movie, Wonder Woman fans I think are going to be pissed when they see this movie because she is way in the back seat. You're absolutely right. Especially after this, her standalone movie is the best DC movie in years. So the handling of her is to Ezra Miller, I wanted to punch him every single time he was on screen. I hated the Flash character. Every single little smart-ass comment he made was not funny and forced. The attempt, you know, because I know DC, you know, the Zack Snyder world of DC has taken it on the chin a little bit for being so dark, you know, and the Christopher Nolan movies are so dark. And they tried to add humor to this. I mean, really, and I emphasize the word tried big time. The action sequences are just incompetent. I don't know what the hell was going on. The villain is ridiculous. It's just a CGI like dude with big horns. The CGI is terrible. The voice is by Kieran Hines, who's a great character actor. And you know, like J.K. Simmons shows up as Commissioner Gordon for like two scenes. Diane Lane's in it for 5 minutes. Amy Adams, you know, is Lois Lane. The whole sequence where they rejuvenate Superman, that whole like set piece where you know they is terrible. And like, where's Batman? Like he shows up like the sequence goes on for like 10 minutes and then Batman shows up and this whole like the idea is that they have to save the world because if this Steppenwolf dude with his horns gets these three boxes, the world's going to end.
Mm-hmm.
And so at one point in the movie, they've got the third box and it's very important that this dude doesn't get the third box, the Steppenwolf dude. So they leave it in the middle of town. Nobody around. They just leave it on a car.
While they fight Superman.
Right. I mean, what the hell? I mean, it's so stupid. Now, I found Jason Momoa and the Aquaman character to be incredibly annoying. I know he's the one that everybody's kind of clinging on to because he's got, like, a lot of the smart-ass laugh lines. But I will say this. The only scene in the movie that put a smile on my face that was played well, and I'm sure Whedon wrote it. I have no doubt in my mind Whedon wrote it. It's when Aquaman is sitting on the Lasso of Truth.
Mm-hmm.
Only moment in the movie that has any life to it whatsoever.
Correct.
And I'm positive Whedon wrote that scene.
The best scene in the movie.
It's out without question. It's the best scene in the movie, and it's the only time that there's any camaraderie between them. Like it's like a 3 minute scene, and that's the only time there's any camaraderie between them. It is a terrible movie. The DC movies are awful. I thought it was absolutely, it was just, and you know, I know it's under 2 hours. It felt like it was 6 hours long. So, yeah, Justice League. Colin, don't bother.
Yeah, I don't think I will.
Yeah, I wouldn't bother if I were you. Okay, let's see. Let's get to another one here. All right. Let's change the mood here. Colin, tell us about Mudbound.
Okay. This was a tough one to describe, kind of, but not really. But it's a film that takes place in the Mississippi Delta and tells the story of two families that share this farmland. And it's a white family and a black family. The white family is headed by Jason Clark and Carey Mulligan, who moved here under the impression that they were getting a better deal than they got. And they have to share that land with the black family, the Jacksons, played by Rob Morgan and Mary J. Blige, which at that time, as you can imagine, was not ideal for either of these families, especially in Mississippi, to try and coexist together on this plot of land. And it's not ideal for the Jacksons. You know, they have dreams of their own, but because of their race, you know, they have a lot more obstacles in their way. The film spans a year or two, I think. I'm not sure. I can't really quite remember the whole timeline here. And eventually these two of the characters go off to fight in World War II and come back and find they have kind of a different attitude towards the Jim Crow South from which they came. So there's a lot of characters here, a lot going on. The film was directed by Dee Reeves, who's a director we haven't heard from in a while. She made a movie called Pariah many years ago that was very good. And this is a film that has a feel of kind of an old, you know, classic novel that maybe you had to read in high school, that just kind of really interesting piece of historical fiction. You know, the conflicts that take place here are aplenty, and you know, every scene is a conflict. Every scene is some underlying tension going on. There is deep racism going on, you know, the white side of the family, particularly with the patriarch. I forgot the actor's name, but he's on Breaking Bad. And
Jonathan Banks.
Jonathan Banks. Yeah.
Thank you. Yes. It was, you know, just basically one of the most hard-nosed, unbelievable racist you've ever met in a film. So there are scenes that are brutal and hard to watch, and then there are scenes of great, you know, tenderness and empathy. And I really think this is a beautiful looking film. It looks very authentic in its period. It spans a lot, you know, I forgot, like I think I said it was a year or so. And, you know, I felt deeply involved with each of them. And it's, on a technical level, just a knockout of a movie. It's beautifully shot. It should be seen on a big screen if possible. And right now it's on Netflix. I'm not sure if it's playing at any theaters right now in the city. I forgot to look that up. But I definitely highly recommend it. The performances are, like, also across the board are fantastic. Yes, including Mary J. Blige. This is definitely one I would highly recommend.
Okay. Everybody hang on, guys. Eric, hang on, and Colin, hang on. And we're going to come back. We're going to take a break here, and we'll come back, and we'll tell you what I thought and what Eric thought of Mudbound. And right after we take a break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower Monday morning, and we're in the middle of the Monday morning movie reviews, and also means my dad will call in and tell a joke, and we're going to talk great quotes, classic quotes from movies past. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. Before the break, Colin told us all about Mudbound and how much he liked it. And now, Eric, what did you think?
I liked it very much, too. I saw this at Sundance back in January, and I was also a fan of Dee Reese's Pariah. And it's a film that I think gets better as it progresses. As the movie begins, it seems like it's possible it might be going, you know, approaching material that we've sort of kind of seen before, and, you know, if it was going to present anything new. And it doesn't really matter because, as Colin mentioned, there's a lot going on in this movie, and there are a lot of plot strands and a lot of characters to follow, and it's a real credit to Reeves that she's able to sort of balance all of that without any of it feeling sort of, you know, forced in any way. And obviously a lot of people are going to be concentrating on the racism angle of the film, which obviously is a very big part of it. But I think the film also works very well as a kind of a testament to how poorly we sort of treat our veterans, people who return from war. And you think about the Jason Mitchell character in this film, how, you know, he's able to go, you know, across the pond and, you know, fight for his country and be a part of something there. And, you know, everyone's, you know, looking out for each other on the right side. And then he comes home to, you know, where he can't sit in the front seat without being, you know, stared at. You know, he just doesn't have the same rights as everyone else. He can fight for his country, but can't sit in the front seat. I mean, it's just, it's real garbage. And then there's real payoffs to all of this. I think Garrett Hedlund has never been better in a film.
Never, ever been better. Yeah.
He's really good in the film. Mitchell's really good. There really isn't a bad link in the film anywhere, and I'm looking forward to revisiting it again before we start filling out ballots this year.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I didn't see it on the big screen. I watched it on Netflix, and so I would like to see it on the big screen because, Colin, as you mentioned, visually it's beautiful. Man, there's a lot of mud in it. There's a lot of mud in it. But yeah, all the cast is great, and what you mentioned, Eric, about, you know, how we treat our veterans, I think that's at the core what the movie really is about. And it's got the racism in it, and it captures the time period really well. And there is a lot of, as you guys mentioned, there's a lot of stuff. This movie's like 2 hours and 15 minutes long, but it's a full 2 hours and 15 minutes. There's no padding. You know what I mean? Like, they use that 2 hours and 15 minutes to flesh out a lot of characters, to concentrate on a lot of storylines, and to, you know, to make a lot of statements. The entire cast is great. Sometimes I need to be reminded how great Carey Mulligan is, because I forget. But she's so great, and she's great in this. Everybody, and Garrett Hedlund, as you mentioned, Eric, I've never been a particularly big fan of the guy.
Yeah.
He's great in it. He's great. This is a very powerful movie. And Mary J. Blige, surprising, really, really terrific in it as well. So it's a really powerful movie, really moving emotional, and it says a lot about that time period in this country and now. I think Mudbound is great, and it's on Netflix, so there you go. All right. Well, Eric, why don't you tell us about Bill Nye Science Guy?
Okay, well, this is a film about Bill Nye, Science Guy, a television a scientist who had his own television show that a lot of people grew up with. I think I was sort of I missed that period when he sort of rose to popularity. I was sort of past the point where I might have been watching.
Well, I was an adult and I watched him all the time.
Okay.
I love the guy. I love Bill Nye. Yeah.
And you know, certainly no knock on him. I just sort of missed a window.
Yeah.
And this film, you know, we've had films and obviously a television show that have, you know, told us, you know, what this guy is about and, you know, what he believes in. But this film is, you know, obviously set in present day and basically has him kind of going around challenging the sort of the skeptics out there, talking about climate change and the way that some people try to use religion sometimes to justify false claims against science. And it's just it's kind of revelatory just watching him go, you know, watch people just doubt on the basis of absolutely nothing, and to see him do public debates. If I remember, I visits the like that big Noah's Ark recreation thing that the guy put up, built himself somewhere. But it also gives us a history about him and, you know, the show itself. And actually, it isn't afraid to get itself a little bit dirty at times, and that it actually kind of goes into how he might have actually screwed over some people that he worked with in the past in regards to the show, intentionally or unintentionally. So it's not a completely favorable approach to him. And that actually gives it a great more depth, that it's not just some, wonderful puff piece about this childhood hero. And I think people who didn't miss that window, like you, Nick, will really enjoy, hearing about the history of that period. And then you have guys like me who are just very happy to see someone out there with the smarts to actually be debating people who just it's just kind of nonsensical what they choose to believe in. This is even sort of before the era of before fake news was, co-opted by certain people.
Yeah.
So it's kind of it's always fascinating to see those types of debates and even occasionally see him. There's actually one guy that he debates in the film, a weatherman, bodybuilding weatherman, whose son was actually in that window. And the weatherman is like completely, trying to debunk all of, science's theories. And his son is caught in the middle of his dad and this kind of hero that he grew up with. And that kind of adds another layer to the film as well. I found it's a very entertaining film. Obviously fans of Bill Nye will enjoy it very much.
Okay, good. I haven't seen it, but I love the guy, so I'm looking forward to seeing it. All right, cool. Now, am I to understand, Eric, that you haven't seen Coco?
I have not.
Oh, boy. All right.
Yeah. Colin, I missed that window, too.
Colin, tell us about Coco.
All right. Well, this is the latest from Pixar, and it takes place in Mexico just before the Day of the Dead festivities. And the story centers on a kid named Miguel who lives in a small village with his family who have banned music from being played in the household. Instead, everyone is focused on the family business, which is in making shoes. But Miguel has musical talents. He can play the guitar quite well and has great admiration for a deceased movie and music star named Ernesto de la Cruz, who's voiced by Benjamin Bratt. Long story short, Miguel finds himself in the land of the dead, where souls have not yet passed on because they've been forgotten by their people. I think that's how that goes. Or that's one of the things that happens in there. So when he's there, if you know anything about Day of the Dead, everybody, looks just like a skeleton, but Miguel doesn't look that way. So he has to put on skeleton makeup to make himself blend in this land of the dead so he doesn't stand out as much. So when he's there, Miguel meets Hector, voiced by Gael Garcia Bernal, and he's kind of a drifter who isn't really tied with anybody, but he helps out the hero on the hero's journey. And there's also an adorable dog who joins him as well. So a lot of this is, you know, Miguel learning about his family, learning about his origins, and learning about where he comes from, why there's this ban on music in his family. And so it's one big origin story for this kid. So this is from Pixar. So we hold Pixar to a very high standard.
Right. Hold on, Colin, we got a break. You come back, we'll give us your review after we break, okay?
Okay.
All right, there's Eric and Colin. We got a break here for the news, and when we come back after the news, we'll hear what Colin thought of Coco, the latest from Pixar, and what I thought of it as well. News is next on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6. Monday morning, and I'm so glad to be back after a long holiday break. And we're back, and we're doing shows, and we're back to full weeks and fun. And we're back with the Monday morning movie reviews. My dad's joke for a Monday morning. We're going to talk about greatest quotes from movies ever. And there you go. Now, we got to get back to the movie reviews here. 312-981-7200 is the talk and text. And before the break, Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back. Colin told us the plot, the basic plot and the background of the movie Coco, which is Pixar's latest. And go ahead, Colin.
Yeah, so as I was saying, this is a Pixar film, and we hold Pixar to a higher standard than many other animation studios because they've set the bar so high. But over the years, you know, their output has been a little lacking, and, you know, they've been sort of slumming it a little bit in, you know, with unnecessary sequels and films that don't quite measure up to the Pixar standard, like Brave and The Good Dinosaur. But this is, I'm happy to say, one of their strongest efforts over the past, you know, 5 or 10 years. Not quite as great as Inside Out, but it is definitely a movie that sort of reminds you of why Pixar has been held to this high standard. It creates a world that is gorgeous to look at, that has its own set of rules that are easy to follow, a very likable protagonist, and very enjoyable side characters and, you know, supporting characters. It takes unexpected turns. It has that emotional punch at the end that we come to expect from a Pixar film. And it's a movie where when it's over, you want to see more of these characters. And so, you know, maybe a sequel wouldn't be so unjustified somewhere down the road. You know, I don't want to get too far into that, but this is a movie that is definitely unexpected from an animation studio of this caliber, mainly just because of, you know, how heavily steeped it is in a particular culture. And I think there's a lot of, you know, great attention placed on, you know, just what the Day of the Dead means. This is a movie that is directed by two people, one Ripley Unkrich, who directed Toy Story 3, and it's co-directed by Adrian Molina, who this is his debut as a Pixar director. And, you know, you can tell that there's somebody behind this who really is paying attention to make sure that everything is done right. It's a really beautiful, beautiful film. I would like to see it again. I think the maybe first half hour or 40 minutes was a little too manic for me at the time. I was sort of getting a little bit of a headache at the time and kind of needed the movie to pull back a little bit. That was just my physical ailment. The movie didn't give me the headache, but that's something I was dealing with at the time. But it just kind of felt like, okay, this movie really needs to calm down a little bit and just, you know, take a breath and stop shouting everything at me. But then, you know, eventually it does. But I'd like to give the movie a second shot when I'm a little more healthy. But nevertheless, this is a really beautiful, terrific film. And the first Pixar movie, I think, ever to not have a short film attached to it.
Did you see that? You saw the critic screening?
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a short film. It's not short.
Oh, is this the Frozen?
Yeah.
Did they actually attach it?
21 minutes long.
Oh, God. I thought they weren't attaching it.
Oh, oh God.
Okay.
No, we were in the theater for 2 hours and 10 minutes. So,
okay.
Yeah, so go ahead, Colin.
Okay, well, spite of that, this is really worth going to see. So, yeah, definitely one of Pixar's strongest efforts in recent years.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. It's the best Pixar movie since Inside Out, and it's wonderful. I was just going to suggest that people show up 20 minutes late because the Olaf thing is just it's cloying, and it was supposed to be a TV special, which is why it's 21 minutes long.
Yeah.
So it was like made for TV. I don't understand why Pixar attached it. I don't know. And I didn't know that it was attached to it. I did, you know, when I looked on the internet after I saw the movie and people were losing their mind over it. So I didn't know. And when it kept going on and on, I was like, what the hell is happening?
Mm.
So by the time the manic part of Coco started, I was happy, Colin. So it was a very different experience. The thing about this movie is, and I'm so glad that you mentioned it, the cultural authenticity of this film, you can feel it, you know, that they really care about it. There are no stereotypes in this. It's not like, you know, it's not like Speedy Gonzales or anything like that. I mean, they really took the time to learn and pay respect to the culture. And there aren't a lot of celebrity voices in this movie. There are a lot of Latinos and Mexican American and Mexicans who are providing the voices here, which lends an authenticity, which Wes Anderson has taken some heat for his Isle of Dogs movie. Have you guys heard about this?
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard about?
No, I know the movie. I didn't know he was getting heat.
He's taking heat because there's not enough Asians voicing characters in it. So it's an all star lineup for Wes Anderson's movie.
Maybe he should have got real dogs to do the voices.
Well, there, yeah, exactly. But anyway, so but this is spectacular visually. It's spectacular. Did you see it in 3D?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, so did I.
And it looked pretty great.
It looked great in 3D. Yeah, and it's a wholly original movie. I've never really seen a mainstream movie that dealt with this kind of story before. The characters are lovely. The music is terrific. It's beautifully paced, and the payoff at the end. You know, it's another Pixar movie that made me cry, and there, I can't. You know, I've lost track of how many Pixar movies make me cry. Seriously, and this one made me cry. I had a nice, good cry at the end. It's a terrific movie and easily the best Pixar movie since what was Inside Out was 2015?
Yeah.
So, it's only
had three, I think, since then.
Yeah. But I mean, they had kind of a little stretch there before Inside Out that wasn't great either.
Yeah. So Monsters University and Brave Cars 2. Yeah,
Cars 2, right. So these are the two standouts, Inside Out and Coco. And Eric, you got to see it, man.
I can't wait. Yeah. I really want to see it.
It's
I'm going to show up late even.
It's terrific. All right. Okay, Eric, tell us about Gilbert.
Okay. Well, this is a new documentary about Gilbert Gottfried. Everyone knows who Gilbert Gottfried is, at least they should. And if they do, whether they like him or don't like him, they know his voice. They know his persona. But the thing about what this documentary is trying to do is to tell you that you probably really don't know him at all. And the film kind of brilliantly kind of opens with a Howard Stern interview that he did, where he calls him into the studio where Howard Stern just like goes, I can't believe I just found this out. You're married?
Yeah.
You know, it's that level of privacy that that Gottfried has sort of perpetuated over the years that we really don't know anything about him except that persona. And this film, just kind of takes us, it shows a lot of his stand-up career and, his history in movies and things like that, just some standard stuff. The thing that really sort of makes this thing hum, other than, how funny some of the stand-up material actually is getting to know Gilbert Gottfried. And I don't think that he completely lets the entire curtain down, but compared to what we've known of him for the past 30 years or so, this is like ripping the curtain down, by comparison.
Mm-hmm.
You have comedians talk about how kind of a legendary cheapskate he he actually is. But in kind of a cute way, not in, you know, in a way that he goes to hotels and he keeps all the toiletries and asks for a free deodorant and stuff like that, and then hoards them underneath his bed. We get to know a little bit about how he met his wife, and you know that he's got two children. It could have gone a little bit further into that. I would have liked to have seen maybe a little more about, because one thing the documentary does show is just that Gottfried, you know, even when he's with his wife, and the film kind of allows us to the man behind the curtain moments, and actually show that scene from The Wizard of Oz in the movie, that he, you know, he can be very guarded, that even when his wife is trying to sort of prod something out of him, you know, something as simple as, hey, how about we go to the gym? He's just constantly just kind of throwing jabs back at her, just kind of, you know, always joking. He's just always on, even in a muted kind of sense. And one of the things that I really liked about this film is that, you know, once you get past all that and it sort of gets into, you know, it goes into the whole aristocrats thing, and how he sort of transitioned from being kind of a comic that wasn't as blue as he is now, and then that was sort of a linchpin moment where he sort of took on a completely different persona, and then also gets into how he ended up losing the Aflac deal. And one of the thing that I really liked, what I really took away from this documentary the most, is the idea of how humor can be used in those kind of tragic situations. And I think it's Bill Burr in the film that says, you know, just because you joke about something doesn't mean you don't care. You know, and I think that's a lesson that I think a lot of people can learn, especially in the culture that we're living in today, that, you know, Gottfried's sort of reaction to what happened when he did those tsunami jokes, really affected him. It's not that he didn't care. That was just his way of dealing with it.
Right.
And, you know, now we live in this Twitter culture, and it's just, you know, I think it's a very timely documentary in that way, too. But you know, the film itself had me laughing really hard. Some of his stand-up material is just gold. And it was just really nice to see this side of, you know, a person that, you know, we've known for decades, but turns out we really haven't really known.
Yeah. My dad's favorite comedian, so he's definitely going to want to see this.
Oh, God, he's going to love it.
I've seen Gilbert Gottfried about five, six times live, and I brought my dad like three or four of those times. He's unbelievable live. He's unbelievable. Yeah. It's available, by the way, on Amazon. You can get it on Amazon, and it's at the Siskel Center. And Gilbert Gottfried, I think, Skyped on at the premiere.
He did. And the other thing, you know, thinking about, you know, all the jokes that are in this movie, you know, there are jokes that you could repeat, you know, not on the radio, obviously.
Right.
But jokes that you could repeat, but coming out of your mouth wouldn't be the same as coming out of Gilbert.
That's exactly right, man. That's the key. That's the key to why I think that's the key to his longevity.
Yeah,
he's Gilbert Gottfried. There's nobody else like him.
And there's actually the one of the moments I laughed at the hardest in the movie. There's actually a bit where he's actually in Pheasant Run in St. Charles, Illinois.
Okay.
And he's booked there to do a show, and he's doing it at the same time that there's some sort of convention for like people who dress up in war memorabilia, like war memorabilia show. And well, after his show, and he's selling his merch, his CDs and stuff, a guy comes up to him in a full Nazi uniform, and there's like this awkwardness between the two of them, and the guy in the uniform says, you know, I'm actually really sorry about the uniform, and Gilbert looks at him and goes, why, it's not wrinkled.
That sums it up right there, man.
Yep.
All right, Eric Collin, hang on. That's Gilbert, and it's available on Amazon, and it's also at the Gene Siskel Film Center. More reviews coming up right after we take a break here on 720 WGN. How's everybody doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trip Tower. We're in the middle of the Monday morning movie reviews. My dad, it's Monday, he's going to call in and tell a jokey joke. And, let's get back to it. And let's welcome Eric back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Colin, welcome back.
Hello.
Colin, tell us about The Man Who Invented Christmas.
All right. Well, this is a rather whimsical take on the origins of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Dickens here is played by Dan Stevens. And at this point in his career, Dickens had great success with Oliver Twist, but he's now floundering after a string of unsuccessful books. And he gets criticism for telling stories about the poor. And he's just made a deal with his publisher and a few others to have this new book out by Christmas that will be a Christmas story of some kind. But he has no idea what it will be. And so he has this tremendous bout of writer's block. But one night he gets inspiration at a graveyard where he encounters an old man who says the immortal phrase, "Bah, humbug." And that gives him the inspiration for Scrooge. And that man is played by Christopher Plummer. And he keeps coming back to Charles as a kind of muse. And as the movie and the story of Christmas Carol takes shape, more of the Christmas Carol characters come to life in Dickens' mind. And there are many scenes where he talks to these characters and they tell him how to write the story and how to tell it. Jonathan Pryce is also in this movie. He plays Charles Dickens' father, who is down on his luck. And that's a kind of a side bar story as well about, you know, that eventually inspires Charles Dickens on how to come about with his ending. And so, like I said, this is a whimsical, kind of a whimsical film, especially when once all the Christmas Carol characters start interacting with Charles Dickens in real life, even though nobody else can see them but him. And we've had a lot of movies that this has kind of become its own genre of movies that are about the inspirations behind classic literature.
Well, we just had the Winnie the Pooh movie 2 weeks ago.
Right, yeah. So that's the most recent example. And I guess this one is a little bit better than that one because of the different approach that it does take to it. So I'm thankful that the movie is at least trying to be different from the other ones. But that whimsy comes at a cost. There are moments in this movie that are just a little too cute and trying a little too hard to be crowd-pleasing. Yeah, but, I mean, Christopher Plummer is obviously very good, and, you know, Scrooge is one of those roles he's kind of born to play, but I'm glad he's playing it as something other than your average Christmas Carol retake, which, I don't know about you, I don't need another version of A Christmas Carol in my life, ever. I've seen enough. I'm done. I got the story. So I'm kind of mixed feelings on this. I want to like it, but there's just a little too much whimsy and a little too much cuteness going on here. Feels a little bit too errs on the side of cuteness a little too often for my taste.
Okay, so that's The Man Who Invented Christmas, which is out right now. Okay, guys, hang on. We've got to take a break. By the way, none of us saw Roman J. Israel, Esquire. I hear bad things, which makes me sad because it's Denzel and it's Dan Gilroy. But I've heard, and Colin Farrell, and I've heard bad things. So
yeah.
I'm disappointed to hear that, which is one of the reasons why I didn't rush out during the break to see it. So anyway, we didn't see that one. Denzel is out there if you are looking for him. All right, we got a break. We got the news coming up. We'll be right back. Yeah, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, and we're here till 5 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday morning, and we're going to talk about some of the greatest quotes from film history and much more. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Check us out on Facebook, which is the best way to stay connected, facebook.com/NickDShow, and follow us on Twitter at NickDShow. We're here till 5, and we are about to review one more movie here. Eric Childress and Colin Suter join me every Monday morning for the movie reviews. And Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
Eric, tell us about Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Okay, well, this is the new film from writer-director Martin McDonagh, who did In Bruges and Seven Psychopaths. This film stars Frances McDormand as a woman who lives in Ebbing, Missouri, whose daughter 7 months ago was the victim of a really horrendous crime. Perpetrators, one or more, have not been brought to justice, and she is popping mad about it. So she purchases three billboards not far from her home, but on this sort of road that seemingly not a lot of people go down, but it's meant to send a message to the police department, particularly the chief, played by Woody Harrelson, about why the cops have not solved this case. Why has her daughter's killer or killers not been brought to justice? Obviously, this causes a great strife within the police community, as it, there are news reports about it, and it brings a lot of unwanted and undue attention on their efforts. But, you know, that's not to say that they haven't actually been trying. Woody Harrelson's character, you know, tries to explain this to her, but she's really having none of it. Also, at the police station is Sam Rockwell, who plays as racist and horrible a police officer as you could possibly imagine. And then there are a number of other characters around town that add to this whole mix, including John Hawkes as from McDormand's ex-husband, Peter Dinklage as a local guy who kind of has a crush on her, Caleb Landry Jones is the guy that sells her the billboards, and many others that we'll meet along the way. So, you know, people familiar with McDonough's previous work in Bruges and Seven Psychopaths knows that he has a pretty unique sense of humor, and in sort of another kind of version of sort of Coen Brothers material, is always, you know, perpetrating, you know, that humor with violence. But this movie is, you know, more about emotional violence than sort of the actual violence. It's a movie that is a call for justice. And the thing about justice is that, you know, the scales are not always equal, and the search for it is often messy and hardly ever perfect. And I think that that's one of the great strengths about this movie, is that it's a movie that plays within those gray areas, and that our heroine is not, you know, exactly innocent of a lot of things herself, particularly as the film goes on. The chief doesn't seem as bad as might be perpetrated by a glance at those billboards, and he has, you know, his own personal things in his personal life going on as well. And then you have, you know, Sam Rockwell's character, who, you know, is about as horrible a human being as you could possibly imagine.
And lives with his equally horrible mom.
Yes, yes, absolutely. who has certainly enabled him over the years. But there are things about him as well that, you know, will surprise you as well. The performances in this movie just, I mean, please. McDormand is, you know, probably in, you know, the front runner right now to win Best Actress once again. This is very much the anti, Marge from Fargo. She is angry. Not that she's not funny at times, and there are times, you know, in this movie again that you are completely with her, particularly in a speech that she gives to a priest that stops by her house. One of my favorite scenes in the movie. And there are other times where you think that she might be the worst person in the film itself. Like you said, I mean, movies like this that scrounge around in that dirty gray area of justice and, you know, the best and worst parts of people is uniformly fascinating to me, particularly when it's done as well as this screenplay is. McDonough's way of, you know, bringing all this stuff together and arriving at a conclusion that, is going to, you know, it leaves more questions than it actually answers at the end, but in a great way. You know, the kind of movie that has you talking about exactly what happens when, you know, the people that we were left with at the end of this movie, what are they going to do? Will they, you know, do it? Will they not? It's a movie that it just demands to be seen. I mean, the Martin McDonagh's output so far in three films is pretty fantastic, and this really is one of the best movies of the year.
Yeah, okay. Colin?
I completely echo that 100%, and this is just one of those great films that I think is probably going to get even better with repeated viewings. And, You know, when it was
I've seen it. I've seen it twice. So yes, it does.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So when I watch this movie, I'm just reminded of what movies can be and how great they can be. Like this is, you know, of course Francis McDormand is in it, and it's got Carter Burwell doing the music. So there's definitely that sort of Coen Brothers feel to it. But this is like every bit as good as Fargo. This is every bit as good as, you know, one of their movies, or even something like Shawshank Redemption. It's like kind of movie that never takes a wrong move, and you can sort of feel it becoming a kind of classic. And it's perfectly cast across the board, too. I mean, even like little supporting characters, actors like John Hawkes and Peter Dinklage, and I think fans of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia are in for a treat when, you know, they see who's cast as Sam Rockwell's mom. And just every scene just crackles with energy, and just there's this great sort of, you can't predict what's going to happen next. This is a great time at the movies. It's what great writing is all about. It's what great acting is all about. This is just going to be very high on my top 10 list. I'm sure of it.
Yeah, this is one of the very, one of the greatest films of the year. There's no question about it. Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri. It's Martin McDonagh's a special talent, man. And I've had friends put up a couple of his plays in the past, and I've seen it. I've seen a lot of his stage work. He's also a great playwright. But his films are phenomenal, and they're unique, and he's got a very distinctive voice. I think this is the best movie he's done, and I think In Bruges is phenomenal. But I think this is his best movie. And there's so much going on in this movie. It's a damn near perfect screenplay, if it's not a perfect screenplay. This is like, you know, it as it goes along, it becomes more interesting and more enveloping, and new things happen. And it's surprising. Every other scene, it takes a surprising turn, but not in some sort of cheap way, but in a way that enriches what's happening on screen and what's happening to the characters and the characters' arc. Sam Rockwell's character has an unbelievable arc that is so satisfying, and a journey that's amazing to watch in terms of its writing, its directing, and Sam Rockwell's superlative performance. He's phenomenal in this movie, as is everybody. Woody Harrelson is great in it. Has some incredibly wonderful moments. John Hawkes is only in two scenes. Who played John Hawkes' 19-year-old girlfriend?
Oh, gosh.
Oh, God, she was amazing. I don't know.
She was unbelievable.
Oh, my God.
She was unbelievable. And she's in two scenes, and she kills in both of them. But the second scene where she talks about a quote that she read on a bookmark. Oh, my God. It's just all across the board. And Caleb Landry Jones plays a good guy, like not a weirdo.
He's a little weird.
He's a little weird, but he's like normally he plays complete nuts, you know.
Yes.
This is just everything that all the characters are memorable, the way it goes on and what the movie is about. The movie is about, you know, getting past blind hatred. The movie's about that quote that 19-year-old girl says. That's what the movie is about, and about how the characters in this movie have to deal with it and have to balance out their feelings with what really needs to be done. It's just so great. And Frances McDormand, I think she's a lock. I mean, come on. And I just want to mention a couple of individual moments in the movie. I love the fact that Sam Rockwell and his mom are watching Don't Look Now. That's one of my favorite moments in the entire movie. And you could hear the score in the background, and I was just laughing my ass off at that. Like, they're sitting around in this stupid town in Missouri drinking and watching Don't Look Now. And Sam Rockwell upset that it's another Donald Sutherland movie. I don't know why. It was so funny. The scene, I just want to mention, there's a moment, I wouldn't dream of giving it away, that there's a moment late in this movie in a hospital room that involves a glass of orange juice. That is as beautiful a scene as I've seen, just in execution, the way it's written, the acting, and one person, you can only see the person's eyes who's doing the acting. It's a stunning piece of writing and a beautiful scene. And as it goes on, there are surprises throughout the movie. And, you know, the relationships change. There's a moment in the movie where Woody Harrelson arrests Frances McDormand and brings her in for questioning because she does something at a dentist's office. So she's in there and he's interrogating her and something happens. Woody Harrelson does something. And the whole scene changes. The whole tone of the scene changes. And McDormand is so on a dime, her reaction to what happens, what Woody Harrelson does and what happens, is stunning. It's a stunning moment to watch. Like, at that moment, it's like the smartass quips and the insults completely stop. You know what I mean?
It's over her face.
Absolutely. It's a stunning moment in the movie, like jaw-droppingly beautiful. And all the way across the board, this is a great movie. This is a great movie. This is the reason why I go to movies. This is that's all there is to it. And I've seen it twice. Saw it twice in 4 days. I took my folks to see it on Saturday. They were blown away by it. The theater was packed, by the way. There aren't enough superlatives to describe how much I love this movie. And it's really going to be near the top of my list at the end. We're going to be talking about this one, and the awards. It's got to get a screenplay nomination. It's got to, right?
Yo, I think screenplay is a lock. I think McDormand is a lock. Rockwell's, I think the heat's going to just continue to build on him until he gets his first nomination.
Yeah.
I think he'll probably get Best Picture nomination as well.
I really hope. This is just great. Oh, by the way, another scene I want to mention, and I'll be as vague as possible. There's a scene where Sam Rockwell, after something happens in the police station, there's a scene where he walks out of the police station and goes across the street to the ad agency where Caleb Landry Jones does and goes in. It's all done in one take, all in one take. And it is an incredible scene, like in terms of execution, in terms of just basic shock and just the way it's shot and the way everybody in that scene acts. That's a jaw-dropping scene. And God, this is a good movie. Man, it's a good movie. Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, one of the very, very, very best films of the year. Eric and Colin and I all echo that. So there you go. So next week, we just got The Disaster Artist?
The Disaster Artist.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm.
What else do we need?
I know. All right, so we got The Disaster Artist next week. A couple of other smaller movies that we'll get to. So there you go. All right, Colin, thanks, man.
All right.
Okay, man, I will talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
Okay, there's Colin. And Eric, you hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, Eric's going to hang on. When we come back, we're going to talk box office. But right now, we got to break here for weather and traffic. I got the weather right here. Good morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are here till 5 a.m. It's the second half of our Monday morning movie reviews where we talk about the box office. Eric Childress writes about the box office and analyzes it at movies.com. Okay, Coco, $71 million. How's that?
It's a very respectable opening. It's exactly what you would hope a movie like Coco would do. But I think that we're going to see how it's going to play now with the word of mouth, which obviously seems to be very good. And there are like basically 2 weeks until Star Wars opens, and almost nothing else is opening.
Right.
So Coco is probably going to lead the box office for the next several weeks if one film below it doesn't overtake it soon enough.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to see exactly how far it drops over the next couple of weeks, whether or not it's going to make $200 million, it kind of remains to be seen. But it's going to have a broader international appeal even than some of the other Pixar films. So it has already made another $85 million internationally already. So it's most likely going to be a hit for Pixar. I wouldn't read too much into the opening this weekend.
Okay. All right. Number two, Justice League, $59.6 million, bringing its total up to $171.5 million. Now, those are disappointing numbers, right?
Oh, very much so.
Yeah.
The fact that this movie last week, when we were off, didn't hit $100 million, on opening weekend,
yeah.
The writing was on the wall, and you know that when a movie studio tries to get ahead of it and just acknowledges that they have a bomb, most places will either ignore it or wait as long as possible before they have to say, like, oh, we had to write this movie off. They're already saying before even this weekend's numbers that it looks like this is going to be a $100 million loser for Warner Brothers.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, this movie needs, and I think it's a low estimate. They're saying it needs to hit $750 million worldwide to hit that. So that, I guess they're only estimating only about $650. It seems like that's a low estimate because with reshoots, this movie cost $300 million.
Wow.
So, $75 million, maybe more than that for print and advertising. $750, I mean, that's certainly the lowest it possibly needs. So, but even that, they're saying it's going to lose $100 million.
Wow. And it's got to be because of, I mean, is it just because of the way that the DC movies, you know?
I don't really quite understand it because all the other DC movies have been successful in some way. Even Batman vs. Superman, which, you know, that movie should have made $1 billion if it was good, but, it, you know, it still made like $875 million or something. And obviously, and the last DC movie, as you mentioned earlier, was their best one. In this recent universe, Wonder Woman, even if I didn't like it, everybody else did. And the fact that this movie is coming off of Wonder Woman and had the lowest opening of any of the DC movies, you know, and I assume it's just because it's more Batman versus Superman fatigue than it is excitement over Wonder Woman.
Yeah. And then, this is a big hit. Wonder, $32.2 million. 69.4. This is a surprise. These numbers are big.
This is a story. This really is a story. And when I saw the numbers, you know, I didn't know how this movie was going to do, if it was going to get buried, you know, but, you know, apparently a lot more people have read the book than even I was aware of.
Yeah. By the way, the real family has been making the rounds on talk shows.
They have.
Big time. The daytime talk shows, which my mom watches. And my mom is, very interested in this movie, like talks about it all the time. So I think that they reached out to a good, the right audience.
Yeah, and I mean, the PG movie, it's, you know, obviously it's, you know, the kind of movie we could all use right now. And, you know, when I saw the opening numbers of like the first estimates last week, the first thing that came in my head was The Blind Side.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, a movie that kind of came out of nowhere, you know, ended up doing, what, $240 million or something ridiculous, and then got a Best Picture nomination. You know, I don't think, you know, I watched this movie over the next couple weeks.
All right, cool. Yeah. Eric, thanks, man.
Sure thing.
All right, we'll talk to you next week. There's Eric Childress, Colin Suter, Movie Reviews, Box Office. We do it every Monday morning. We're going to take a break right now for the news on 720 WGN.